So go ahead and turn to the book of Ecclesiastes in the Old Testament. And we're going to be looking at Ecclesiastes chapter 2 as we go through our series in the book of Ecclesiastes. By the way, if you grab the bulletin on your way in, and it's not too late, you can grab one. Inside the bulletin is a teaching sheet where you can follow along with some of the main points of the message, fill in the blanks, a great opportunity to sort of help you remember the main points later on, and to stay on track here. I came across a very interesting article. This is from the New Yorker back in 2010, and in it, there was a study of three groups of people who had recently been given a lot of money. And so the first group was a group of lottery winners. The second group was a group of paralyzed accident victims who ended up being awarded money. And then the third group was just a control group. And so they asked these three different groups of people different questions about their happiness. And this is what they found. Some of it is obvious and some of it I sound interesting. Here's the obvious part. The lottery winners viewed winning a positive experience, while the accident victims viewed their experience as negative. That's obvious, right? All right, so, but the study went on to find that the lottery winners were significantly less happy when buying things compared to the accident victims. Overall, they found that paraplegics were happier in life than the lottery winners. I don't know about you, but that was one of those things that make me go, made me think about that. Why is that? Both groups got a large amount of money, so why is only one group happy? And why not the other? So I want you to hold on to that thought, because the general answer to that question is going to be given as we get along, further along in our passage this morning. Last week, we looked at Ecclesiastes chapter 1, and then the very end at chapter 12 as well. And we saw that life under the sun does not satisfy. So life here on earth is meaningless. In fact, we can only find meaning through a relationship with Jesus Christ, who is above the sun. This raises an important question, though. Since work and since pleasure and since everything else under the sun is meaningless, then what are we, as people who believe in Jesus, what are we to do with all this meaninglessness around us? Are we to, I don't know, live like this guy up on the screen? Let's pull him up. This is Maxime. Maxime lives in the country of Georgia, and he's a monk. And for the past 20 years, he has lived a life of solitude 130 feet up on top of a pillar in the mountains. And some of you parents with young kids are like, that doesn't sound too bad. He became a monk after spending time in prison, and he lived in that area, so he knew that hundreds of years prior, other monks had lived up there, and so he moved up there one day 20 years ago, and he has lived in that spot ever since. And so he does this to avoid all the distractions of life, and he has lots of time now to pray. Now, there's many examples of people doing this throughout the past 2,000 years. And so I want to ask, is this an example we should follow? Is this an example we should follow? Since pleasure is meaningless, should we just seek to avoid it completely and go live on top of the mountain? Now, contrast what Maxime is doing with what we are told is the American dream, what we here in America grow up sort of aspiring for. We're told that it's normal to desire to prosper, to be happy, to live the American dream. We want that big house. And once we're in the big house, we want the bigger house, right? We want the nice car. And then once we have the nice car, we want the even nicer car. And we want all the fancy stuff that goes along with that. And so to dream of having all of that, is that what we as Christians should want? Is that how we should live? Or should we avoid it completely? Or is there another answer? So we're going to explore that in Ecclesiastes chapter 2. So Solomon, as we saw in chapter 1, is in the midst of an experiment. He's looking around. He's trying to find meaning. And if you know anything about Solomon, he is the king of Jerusalem, and he's a prosperous king. So he's smart, he's popular, and he's filthy rich. And so he has the means to try all these different things. And so we saw in chapter 1 that he looked at work, and we'll see in part of chapter 2 and 3 that he looks at work as well. But he looked at work, and he looked at learning, and he concluded that both of those tasks, both of those endeavors are meaningless, meaning that you can't find satisfaction, you can't find ultimate meaning from those. And so now he's going to turn to a different area of life, and that's the area of pleasure. He's going to try to accumulate things. He's going to try to get things to make him happy. And he says this in verse 1. I said in my heart, come now, I will test you with pleasure. Enjoy yourself. But behold, this also was vanity. Vanity, it's meaningless. It's a chasing after the wind. So right here in verse 1, he gives his conclusion to everything, and that is that it's meaningless to try to find satisfaction in life from pleasure. That it's meaningless. So trying to use pleasure as a way for ultimate satisfaction in life is just like chasing after the wind. It's like chasing after something that we cannot truly get. It's pointless. Now you may be thinking, he probably didn't do it right. If I had everything that he had, I would have done better. But to prove you otherwise, we're going to look at the next 11 or so verses, 10 or so verses, and I'm going to show you that he has you beat in every area that you could even possibly try. So let's start with verse 2. I said of laughter, it is mad, and of pleasure, what use is it? So he starts out with something, fairly easy, with comedy, with having a good time. Not just funny videos, funny puppy videos on YouTube. He says it's mad. So he's referring to funny things that are morally perverse. And so he went the route of humor through coarseness, of perversion. In other words, he had a good old time with the boys. He had a good old time just living it up, not worrying about the perversity of things, and he enjoyed it. But what is his conclusion? He says, what use is it? So after going to that comedy club, after that Joker guy comes, and after making all these perverse jokes, at the end of the night, he concludes, what use is all of that? And I think most of us can probably identify with him. Most of the entertainment in our culture falls into this category where it's perverse, but it's also ultimately meaningless. It's meaningless. What point, what use is it in this? And so he moves on to something else. Verse 3. I searched with my heart how to cheer my body with wine, my heart still guiding me with wisdom, and how to lay hold on folly, till I might see what was good for the children of man to do under heaven during the few days of their life. So he gives alcohol a try. And he explores every possible, and we know from all these different verses that he doesn't just take one glass of wine, give it a little sip, maybe gives it a little shake, like I guess they do, at least I see them do in the movies. Or what, I don't know. I'm not an experienced wine drinker, but he is. He tried it all, and he found what? He found it didn't have much meaning. He found what most of us who have tried it before probably have found, where it might bring a little bit of pleasure. It might even help you escape from some of the troubles of your life. But when you wake up the next day, then you find that fun or that escape is gone. And so you find that it is meaningless. It's meaningless. He also, we know from other passages, had some big old parties. 1 Kings chapter 4 gives a list of the provisions that he needed each day, and I'm not going to read those, but according to one pastor I read, the provisions that are listed in 1 Kings 4 shows that he likely was feeding about 30,000 people each day. Can you think of a party that even had half that many people? We have a good old Thanksgiving banquet each Thanksgiving time. A lot of fun, 100, 200 people. And we're exhausted by the end of that night, and we're Baptists here. Solomon had a good old time with the wine, with the party, and all of that, with massive amounts of people. Massive amounts of people. Didn't work. Didn't work. And so he tries a different approach. Verse 4, he says, I made great works. I built houses and planted vineyards for myself. And I made myself gardens and parks and planted in them all kinds of fruit trees. I made myself pools from which to water the forest of growing trees. So he moves from alcohol to building and to creating. Now, this reminded me of the Biltmore Estate. I got to visit there a couple of years ago. And it's a really nice house in Asheville, North Carolina. And this house here, it was built by George Vanderbilt back in 1889. So in 1887, he visited Asheville and he was like, I want to live here. And so he bought up all the land in 1888. And then he started building in 1889. And it took him 6 years to build the house. And so his finished house contains more than 4 acres of floor space in there. It's massive. It contains 35 bedrooms, 43 bathrooms, and 65 fireplaces. Can you imagine having to scrub 43 toilets? That's a lot of work. In addition to the house, he hired a guy, Frederick Olmsted, to design the forest around him. And so he's the guy that created or that designed Central Park. And so all around his forest, he has these perfectly designed hills and forests and everything around that. And Vanderbilt enjoyed his house for a whole 20 years until he died in 1914, passing along to his family. Now, I wonder, there's no way of knowing, but I wonder if we had been there at his deathbed, what he would have thought of all that time and all that energy that he put into his house as he was getting ready to die, the house that would almost bankrupt his family later on. What would happen? Well, Solomon tried the same thing. He built and he built and he built. And in fact, his house took him 10 years to make. And we know that it wasn't just one house. He uses the plural there. So he built houses. And so he built all sorts of stuff. He built the temple for God. He built houses for himself. He built houses for his many wives. And he built massive forests and everything and parks all around there. So he built and he built and he built. I remember when we were getting ready to move up here from Maryland, up here to New Hampshire, and we were starting to look at houses online. And when we looked, I went on to the search and I typed in the amount that we could go up to, and I looked at those houses. And then just out of curiosity, I upped the number a lot to see what kind of houses I could not get, but could maybe dream of getting. And let me tell you, if money were not a factor, we would not be living in the house we ended up in because we saw some really, really nice houses here in the area. And I think that we've all probably experienced something like that where you think, if only I had more money, then I would be able to get that nicer house. Then I would be able to get that nicer car. Then I'd be able to get that nicer computer or that newest phone. But here's the thing. Solomon experienced those same thoughts, but he wasn't limited by a budget. He just went out and bought everything. So everything he wanted, he bought. A new house? Sure. The newest, fanciest chariot with the fanciest camel or horse or whatever pulls the chariot? Have at it. Redesign the forest surrounding your house? Of course. So he had all these things. He experienced the ultimate of materialism. But did it bring him meaning? Did it bring him happiness or satisfaction? And the answer is no, it didn't. And so he moves on to possessions. He says in verse 7, I bought male and female slaves. I had slaves who were born in my house. I also had great possessions of herds and flocks. More than any who had been before me in Jerusalem, I gathered for myself silver and gold and treasure in the treasure of kings and provinces. So last week on Facebook, I was just perusing about, and I saw this ad on Facebook of this new service that you can go to hire a housekeeper. And I clicked on it. I was genuinely interested. And I looked at it longingly after I looked at everything, and they said they clean your toilets and they go around, they straighten up everything. And I was like, that seemed nice. That seemed nice. But Solomon didn't just look at a housekeeper. He bought the whole company. Are you tracking with me? Solomon was able not to just hire a service. He bought people to do all those for him full time. It's sort of like being on Downton Abbey or the Crown on steroids. You've seen those shows, right? Something like those where, you know, it's those rich British people who wake up in the morning. And they don't have to do anything. Someone is there ready with breakfast in bed. And they open the curtains for them. And when they're ready to get out of bed, they just stand up. And then someone goes and puts the clothes on for them. And if they want more coffee, they don't even have to say anything. They just point. And the guy from the corner comes over and he pours the coffee into the cup. Listen, if I tried that at home and pointed at my cup, my wife would laugh at me. He goes on to say, I got singers, both men and women, and many concubines, the delight of the sons of man. And so he moves on from possessions to pleasure, to sexual pleasure. In 1 Kings chapter 11, we know that he had 700 wives and 300 concubines or prostitutes. And so there was basically no sexual pleasure that he could not get. He probably never complained to his wife about her being boring because he had a new wife every day. He wanted whatever he wanted, he had. All his fantasies became a reality. And so this was his life. Verse 9, and so I became great and surpassed all who were before me in Jerusalem. Also, my wisdom remained with me, and whatever my eyes desired, I did not keep from them. I kept my heart from no pleasure, for my heart found pleasure in all my toil, and this was my reward for all my toil. Let me summarize all these verses from one commentator. He writes, he had the most success, the best houses, the most possessions, the richest lifestyle, the most sophistication, the finest wines, the most incredible parties and feasts, the greenest lawns, the best servants, more money than we could possibly imagine, military fame, popularity, endless entertainment, and as much sexual pleasure as anyone could ever indulge in. He had it all. He had it all. If there was a Lifestyles of the Rich and Famous Jerusalem edition, he would be at the top of the list every time. If there was a MTV Cribs, they would be looking at his house every week. Of all the people in the world, he would be the happiest, right? He would be the most satisfied, it seems. Well, listen to what his conclusion is. Verse 11, then I considered all that my hands had done, and the toil I had expended in doing it. And behold, all was vanity into striving after the wind. And there was nothing to be gained under the sun. A while back, there was a 60 Minutes interview with Tom Brady, and he was talking sort of about success. And this is what he said. Tom Brady said, "Hey man, this is what it is. I reached my goal, my dream, my life. Me, I think it's got to be more than this. I mean, this can't be all, it can't be what it's all cracked up to be." And so the interviewer asks him, "What's the answer?" And Brady says, "I wish I knew. I wish I knew." Coming from the man who won many Super Bowls, who had lots of money, who had a supermodel wife, he says, "This can't be all there is." So, church, we must see this before we move forward. We must see that we will never find true, lasting satisfaction from pleasure. We will never find lasting satisfaction from pleasure. And if we try, we're going to be chasing after the wind. We're going to be wasting our life. You're going to be left saying, to quote you two, "But I still haven't found what I'm looking for." So in the next section now, he's going to talk a little bit about why all this pleasure is meaningless. And so Solomon gives one of the reasons here, and the reason is the reality of death looms over everything, making it all meaningless. Let me read a couple of those verses. Verse 15. "Then I said in my heart, what happens to the fool will happen to me also. Why then have I been so very wise? And I said in my heart that this also is vanity. For of the wise also, of the fool, there is no enduring remembrance, seeing that in the days to come, all will have been long forgotten." Here's the key right here. How the wise dies just like the fool. And so I hated life. Can you imagine? The guy that had it all says, "I hated life because what is done under the sun was grievous to me. For all is vanity and a striving after the wind." Let's skip to verse 20. "So I turned about and gave my heart up to despair over all the toil of my labor under the sun. Because sometimes a person who has toiled with wisdom and knowledge and skill must leave everything to be enjoyed by someone who did not toil for it. This also is vanity and a great evil." And so what he's trying to say here is that if he could bring it all with him, that if acquiring things could be continued on after this life, then it would be meaningful. If pleasure led to something lasting, if it sort of accumulated over time, then it would be meaningful. But death, sadly, is the great equalizer of things. All those possessions that he acquired were going to be left to someone else. We've all probably heard that phrase, you never see a hearse pulling a U-Haul trailer. You just don't. They can't take it with them. And to make matters worse, as Solomon noted, what he earned in this life is just going to be passed on, most likely to someone who probably doesn't deserve it. One study recently showed that 60% of inherited wealth is gone by the end of the second generation. In Solomon's own family, it's actually sooner than that. In the very next generation, his entire fortune is carried off by a foreign army in 1 Kings 14, 25 and 26. And so this again raises the question that I asked at the beginning here. If it's all meaningless, then why do it? Why should we even pursue it? To quote the singer, the jazz singer Peggy Lee, in her 1963 song, "Is that all there is? Is that all there is? If that's all there is, friends, then let's keep dancing. Let's break out the booze and have a ball if that's all there is. So last week, I started talking about how the answer is Jesus Christ. How the answer to all the meaninglessness of life is found in Jesus Christ. And when you put your faith in him, he gives you an eternal perspective. He gives you a different perspective on things. But with everything I just said, it raises another question. How do you do that? How do you actually live it out? If pleasure and materials are meaningless, then what do we as Christians do with all this stuff? Do we go like Maxime and sell it all and go live up on a mountain or down in our basement? Well, I want to give you the answer right now. We can and should enjoy the pleasures God has given us if we accept them as a gift from him. Verse 24. There is nothing better for a person than that he should eat and drink and find enjoyment in his toil. Now, if he stopped there, we were thinking he was sort of going in the direction of Peggy Lee. But then he continues. This also I saw is from the hand of God, for apart from him, who can eat and who can have enjoyment? For to the one who pleases him, God has given wisdom and knowledge and joy. But to the sinner, he has given the business of gathering and collecting, only to give to the one who pleases God. This also is vanity and a striving after the wind. So this is important for us to see. Even though pleasures are meaningless, he does not say that we should just avoid all the pleasures out there. Solomon says in verse 24, he says, this pleasure is from the hand of God. For apart from him, who can eat and who can have enjoyment? In other words, Solomon is recognizing that God is the one who gave him those things. And so he's going to enjoy those things in God. In God. Think back to the Garden of Eden, where everything Adam and Eve were given, even the work that they had, were given for the purpose of communing with God, of glorifying God. And so they didn't live like monks. They didn't just live and just pray all the time. They enjoyed their life, but they enjoyed it knowing that it all came from God. They went about their day, enjoying their activities, giving glory to God in their activities. A great example of this is the honeymoon. When you get married, you go off on this fancy little vacation. This is our honeymoon. I look exactly the same every time I look back at my pictures here. And we hiked in Costa Rica, and we ate food, and we enjoyed the beach. And we had all these fun activities, but what were all the activities for? They were all for the purpose of spending time together. They're all for the purpose of enjoying each other, of getting to know each other. And so it wasn't like we just went and did these activities for our own enjoyment. We did them together because we enjoyed spending time with each other and getting to know each other. And you see, in life, there are many, many pleasures available. And God wants you to enjoy the pleasures. But he does not want you to enjoy them in your selfishness. He wants you to enjoy them by getting to know him better, by glorifying him in those pleasures. And so once sin entered the world, the whole dynamic of things changed. After sin entered the world, instead of glorifying God in the pleasures, instead of trying to find satisfaction in the pleasures, man began to look to the created things for satisfaction in and of themselves. And that's the wrong dynamic. Solomon is saying, enjoy life, but with God at the center of it. Take them as their gifts from God. And so to quote the poet Ann Bradstreet, only Jesus satiates the soul. And when you have been satiated with Jesus, then and only then are you in a perfect position to enjoy the other things that he's given you, that he's blessed you with. Let me give you a couple of good quotes that I read from different people here. With Jesus at the center, here's the first quote, "The very pleasures that failed to satisfy us now help us to find even greater joy in the goodness of God." Second, one pastor said, "Pleasure is only safe for us when God is there." This never happens when we take pleasure for ourselves. Or make it our main passion in life. It only happens when we receive every pleasure as a gift from God, the way David did when he said, "In your presence there is fullness of joy. At your right hand are pleasures forevermore." One last quote. Once we learn how to find our satisfaction in God himself, then all his gifts become the best and truest pleasures. And so, church, I want to encourage you. Enjoy the pleasures that God has given you. Enjoy what God has blessed you with. But remember, use that as a filter of knowing what pleasures to enjoy. Can you glorify God in that pleasure? And so, can you get pleasure out of sin? Yes. But can you glorify God in that sin? And the answer is no. And so there's certain pleasures that, yeah, we should not participate in or indulge in, but that's because they distract us from what pleasures are there for, and that's to enjoy the presence of God in our life. And so enjoy them, but make sure they're ones that help us to stay focused on God. I want to close with this thought here. I'm not a big painting guy. When our schools went on trips to the different, we lived in D.C. or outside of D.C., so we'd go to like to the art museum and everything. I'd look around, but I didn't know what I was looking at. Yeah. But I read about this painting, and this one's pretty interesting. This one is called the Ship, with a P, of Fools, and it was painted by Hieronymus Bosch. I'm probably saying his name wrong. And it hangs in the Louvre in Paris. And the painting has all sorts of symbolism. In the boat there are 10 men. And then there's two other men that are outside the boat just swimming around. Now, if you notice, there's no captain in there. So everyone's just doing their own thing, not knowing where the boat is heading, where the wave is taking them. So some are enjoying pleasure, some are flirting, some are singing, some are feasting, but none of them have an idea about where they're headed. And then above them, a guy is trying to get some carrots that are dangling further above. And then further above that, if you notice, there's a skull. And that's the 13th man that apparently in that time was considered a very unlucky number. And what it's symbolizing there is that while these 12 people float about in their boat, not knowing where they're going, the only one that truly knows is that skull, because they're headed in the direction of death. Now, let me ask you, is your life like that painting? Is your life like that painting where you're oblivious to everything around you as you're just sort of indulging in your own pleasures? Now, if you're without Jesus, if you've never asked Jesus to be the Lord of your life, then you are like this painting. And I want to encourage you that even right now, you can call out to him and ask him to be your Lord and Savior. You can ask him, say, "Lord, come into my boat and be my Lord." And if you'll do that, then he will give you meaning in your life, and he will give you meaning in the midst of the pleasures that you pursue. But many of us probably have done that before. And if that's you, I want to encourage you. Maybe some of you have asked him to be the Lord of your life in the past, but you've given him a little shove out of your boat. And I want to encourage you, in a moment, we're going to be taking communion, and then after that, we're going to be singing. During that time is a great opportunity to reflect on your life and to just stop and say, "God, Maybe I've strayed a little bit. Maybe I've pushed you out of the boat, but I need you to come back in. Help me to enjoy life. Help me to enjoy pleasure with you at the center. And that's what each of us are called to do. Yes, enjoy what God has blessed you with, but do it with Jesus Christ at the center. Amen. Let me go ahead and pray for us.